Last week's debate with all the remaining Democratic candidates was the last debate before the Iowa caucuses. And there were a few big moments that we've heard a lot about, like this one in response to the unfolding controversy over whether Bernie Sanders told Elizabeth Warren in 2018 that a woman could not win the presidency.
Can a woman beat Donald Trump? Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women, Amy and me.
But for the Iowa-based moderator of the debate, which took place at Drake University, the chance to ask the candidates what Iowans and rural Midwesterners want to know was the real opportunity of the night. Here she is taking candidates to task on their position on a new trade deal with Mexico and Canada. Sanders opposes the deal because he says it's only a modest improvement from NAFTA. Here's Brianne Fonensteel of the Des Moines Register.
Aren't modest improvements better than no improvements for the farmers and manufacturers who have been devastated here in Iowa?
The answer is we could do much better than a Trump-led trade deal.
He goes on to explain why.
But Senator Sanders, to be clear, the AFL-CIO supports this deal. Are you unwilling to compromise?
The AFL-CIO does, the Machinist Union does not, and every environmental organization.
When his argument pivots to climate change, Brianne's not having it.
Unlivable.
We're
going
to get to climate change, but I'd like to stay on trade. Senator Warren.
Well, they are the same in this issue.
Senator Warren.
Phew. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we are about to get to know the journalist who spoke for Iowans on that stage. She's at the Des Moines Register now, but she's actually from Lawrence, Kansas. And she got her start at the Kansas City Star. Brianne Fonensteel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This was your first time moderating a debate like this. It must have been kind of a crazy thing to wrap your head around.
It was. I'm a print reporter. I write for our newspaper and our website. So TV is not my comfort zone at all. And so this was, it was a really fun experience, but there was a lot of, it was very nerve-wracking to kind of wrap my head around what this meant.
That moment we just heard revealed a pretty impressive level of determination to ask questions on behalf of people who exist outside the urban centers on the coasts, where so much of the conversation does get framed up until the Iowa caucus.
Yeah, it's amazing, even, you know, and especially this week when so much of the conversation out of D.C. is about impeachment and what that means for Donald Trump. And here in Iowa and across the country, there are just so many other issues that are really pressing to voters that don't always get a lot of time. And so, you know, we talk a lot about what it means to be a local reporter covering the Iowa caucuses and what issues we get to highlight and how we can, you know, be a voice for our communities.
Iowa has held this special place in the electoral process for so long, I think most of us kind of take it for granted, but there have been murmurs lately of moving that first primary in the country from Iowa to either Nevada or California. And the proponents of that shift, even though it's still just murmurs, they say those states represent the real America in the 21st century in a way that Iowa doesn't. What are your thoughts on that?
So this is an issue that comes up pretty much every 4 years when Iowa takes the focus. And, you know, there's a conversation around whether it should be first or whether someplace else is more representative of the country overall. And kind of rooted in that is right now, especially a conversation around diversity. Iowa is about 90% white. And so there are other states that are far more diverse and far more reflective of the country at large. And so there are good arguments on both sides of it. People will look at the first four nominating states and say, well, collectively, those reflect the country pretty broadly. But I think one of the more compelling arguments for Iowa is that it's a state that you can actually compete in if you don't have a lot of resources. You know, it's a relatively small state. The media markets are very cheap, so you don't need a lot of money to advertising or to come here to campaign. And so it gives a level playing field for people to kind of rise from obscurity. And this year, I'm thinking about Pete Buttigieg. The first events that I covered of his this cycle were in somebody's living room. There were maybe a dozen people there, and now he's in the top tier here in Iowa. But that may also be kind of the counterpoint. People look at his candidacy and say, well, he's not doing as well with African-American voters in South Carolina, so maybe another state should be in charge of this whole thing. So it's a conversation we hear regularly, and it does feel like things are kind of ratcheting up right now, and we'll be paying attention to that for a while, I think.
We'll get back to this shortly. I think it's pretty interesting and there's a lot to unpack. But first, I want to learn more about you. You're from Lawrence. Tell me about your family, your childhood, what Lawrence was like for you as a kid.
Well, Lawrence has a really special place in my heart. I grew up there. I went to Lawrence High School. And then when I went to college, I was looking around and I decided to stay at KU for their journalism program. So I was born and raised in Lawrence, graduated from the University of Kansas. My first job out of school was in Kansas City. I was working for the Kansas City Star on their politics team. So it was really fun to be close to family and to, again, be a local reporter and feel like you're a voice for your community.
Tell me about sort of like your vantage point there in Lawrence as a kid. I mean, what was your family involved in? What was your particular sort of like niche there?
Well, my mom worked at the university. She was an accountant. My dad is a physical therapist. My brother also went to Lawrence High School and KU. So I think it was pretty normal childhood, but we would spend a lot of time growing up walking down Mass Street and going into the shops and, walking around on campus. And Lawrence is it's a really fun place to grow up, especially in proximity to the university. You know, you have your, I remember growing up, one of my best friends, her parents worked in the geology department. So we would go hang out there in the summertime and like draw on the chalkboards in classrooms. And so it was a fun place to grow up.
The New York Times ran a profile of you where you are quoted as saying that you were the weird kid. And I feel like I'm going to need to know a little more about that.
Well, I'm glad they picked that quote as the first one in this profile. My point was that I always knew growing up that I wanted to be a journalist. I kind of don't think I ever entertained another profession. I always loved writing growing up. I remember being little and writing like a newspaper that I would circulate at Christmas time, like about, you know, NSYNC and what was happening at Christmas, like very little kid stuff. But, you know, the idea that somebody would pay me to write for a living sounded like a pretty cool thing. And so I wrote for my student newspaper in junior high school and high school, and then worked at the University Daily Kansan when I was in college. And so this is something that I have always wanted to do.
Do you think back on anything that you wrote as a student journalist in Lawrence from middle school on up that seems sort of like eerily prescient or something, like something that you actually still think about?
I don't know that I think about anything that I wrote in middle school. It all feels very cringy to me now, how much I've learned since then. But there's a lot of stuff, especially from college, that I'm really proud of. You know, we had a lot of alcohol-related deaths when I was a student at KU. And so the student newspaper put a big spotlight on that. And actually, I think was part of some changes that followed afterward.
Early on, did you have experiences that you think have really shaped the kind of journalism that you wanted to do or the kind of voice you wanted to add to the mix?
I think I've just always wanted to be true to what we're seeing on the ground. You know, I have done a lot of politics, but I've also kind of jumped around and done some other coverage. I've done some feature writing. I've done just some straight local news coverage. But I've always kind of gravitated to public policy and state government. When I first got to the Register, I was a state house reporter, and that is some of the most fun I've ever had being a reporter.
Tell me about why. Can you describe that work for people who don't work in journalism, who have never been in a state house?
Yeah, being in a state capital, there's just so much energy. There are so many people running around and there's so much happening. And so much of it is deeply consequential to people on a very real level. You know, it's not electing a president of the United States, but it's changing the policy about, what your kids might be learning in school or what kinds of health care you have access to, things that really affect people on a very tangible level. And so I loved getting to dig into just a huge variety of issues. Any day you can show up in something different. different is coming along. You know, you have everyone that you could possibly want to talk to kind of all in one building. So if you ever, for some reason, find yourself bored, you can take a walk and just start talking to people, and you'll have 10 new story ideas by the time you get back to your desk. So the energy is really great. And that's something that I try to keep in mind in politics coverage with this, is that there are issues and not just the politics of who's ahead or who's behind that are really affecting people's lives.
How do you see sort of an issue reframing the conversation that we're having right now about different candidates on the Democratic side? How do you see pick an issue where looking at it through that issue is very different from looking at it through that sort of horse race perspective?
Well, I think it's true of a lot of issues, right? We did some coverage a while, but we've done this twice now, where we spent basically a month on the trail, and we had all of our reporters who were out covering events log the questions that Iowans were asking at campaign events. And so we would keep a spreadsheet. And so you got just this huge range of issues that people have on their minds. And so when you know, if you turn on cable news, read the Des Moines Register, sometimes it might feel like Medicare for All is the only issue that people care about. But even just within the prism of healthcare, there's so much more that people are caring about. It's mental health issues. It's access to rural care. It's, you know, here in Iowa, the closing of maternal health centers and labor delivery units. It's addiction treatment. You know, there's just this huge range of issues that happen. And so when you spend a day on the trail, when you are out talking with, in my case, Iowans, you get a better sense of the things that are on people's mind, and it kind of helps for us refocus on what's important to our readers.
Gender was a really big part of the debate in Iowa last week, and the fact that two out of the three moderators, you being one, were women seemed significant to me as part of that. But I'm curious, even more broadly, whether you think it matters who is asking the question, particularly in interviews with politicians.
Absolutely. I mean, I think representation matters at all levels. Not only were there two women, there is a woman of color. So I was really proud of that. And I think about in our newsroom, you know, journalism has a long way to go in terms of diversity and having diverse newsrooms. But I think it's really important, not just gender and racial diversity, but diversity of lived experiences and what people bring to the table. And so we talk a lot about rural versus urban and being able to understand where people are coming from and have a diverse way of thinking about the world is important as well.
You started out, as we've talked about, at the Kansas City Star. Do you have memories of exciting stories you worked on there, or just lessons you learned from that politics desk?
I learned so much working at the Star. That was my first job right out of college. And so they had some grant money for, they called it the Midwest Democracy Project, to cover the 2010 midterms. And so they hired me and a bunch of other recent grads to kind of embed in their political team. And so I got to work with Dave Helling and Steve Kraske and all of their really great beat reporters. And I remember just sitting there and like listening to them work the phones. And so it's maybe not a really sexy story, but just like the way that they would communicate with sources and the way that they would pursue stories was amazing as a young reporter. And so that was a really transformative time in politics too. So especially looking back, the rise of the Tea Party and kind of that wave election is really fascinating. And so that was a lot of fun to get to cover.
What fascinates you about that moment from the perspective of someone covering politics in 2020?
Well, I think it's just when we saw a lot of backlash starting to build. And so I think we hear echoes of it today, and we see the effects of that still lingering today. But the 2020 election is just so interesting on so many different levels. And so I'm really grateful to kind of be on the front lines of it, to get to see it in real time, because I don't know that we're going to see a moment like this for a while.
Breanne Fonenstiel is my guest. She was a moderator of the last Democratic debate before the Iowa primary that'll happen in a couple of weeks. When we pick back up, we'll be asking you if the Iowa caucus feels important to you as a Midwesterner. Do you think this part of the country is well represented in the national discussion outside of the caucus? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking to Breanne Fonenstiel of the Des Moines Register. She's a Lawrence, Kansas native and a Kansas City Star alum. She just helped moderate the last Democratic debate in Iowa, the one that happened last week. Call 816-235-2888 to join our conversation about the Midwestern voice in national politics. That's what we're going to be focusing on now. Hi again, Breanne.
Hi.
So back to this question about how concerns of people living here in this region do or don't get addressed on the national stage. Can we back up to 2016 on that? Because after the last presidential election, where the results took a lot of people by surprise, one of the big takeaways on the national level seemed to have been that maybe people on the coasts don't get us at all and really haven't been paying close enough attention. Do you think that's what 2016 revealed?
I think that was one of the things that 2016 revealed, that a lot of reporters kind of had an idea of what the narrative was baked into their brains and kind of, wrote stories that reflected that without doing a whole lot of real reporting, without spending a lot of time in the places where sentiment had really shifted, where there was a lot of anger. And so I think we saw kind of an immediate maybe overcorrection on that part, where we saw a lot of East Coast reporters coming into Iowa diners and sitting and trying to find, you know, the Trump swing voter. And so I think that's leveled out a little bit now going into 2020, where people have been a little bit more intentional about, spending actual time in these places rather than parachuting in and deciding to be almost tourists a little bit, like it's an anthropology expedition. So there was an overcorrection, I think, that frustrated a lot of people. And now I think we've seen that even out, but I do think people have realized that you can't expect to write about places if you don't understand them, if you haven't spent time there talking to people who live there.
You know, one of my colleagues has talked about the search for the guy in the overalls in the diner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see a lot of that. And that's not always true either. And, you know, part of being a reporter is understanding that trends change. You can't fixate too much on what's happening because you have to be attentive to what might be changing in the future. You know, 2018, we saw different trends. We saw suburban women really come out and change the shape of the 2018 midterm electorate. So you kind of have to just be on your toes and aware and talking to as many people as possible so that you don't miss something. And of course, we're all human. We're going to miss things. But the hope is that you're not so narrowly focused, whether it's on D.C. or whether it's on the Trump voter in the diner, that you miss the bigger picture.
There is this kind of tendency, I feel like, still to lump people together from the whole of America that is not found in coastal urban centers. Even if I'm just looking at the greater Kansas City metro, I would have a really hard time generalizing about what people do for a living, how much of an education they have, what motivates them politically, what they hope for their future. When you broaden that out to everyone who doesn't live in New York, D.C., or L.A., it's bananas.
It is. And it's funny, in this role, I get a lot of people asking me, well, what do Iowans think right now? And it's like, okay, well, which Iowans? You know, we get a lot of attention because we're mostly white. We lack a lot of ethnic diversity and racial diversity. But, you know, there's so many different ways of thinking just within the city of Des Moines. And as you mentioned, you know, across the state, it's really hard to lump people together. So I kind of hate that question because it's so hard to answer. But I think that comes with being in Iowa. And I do have to give props to a lot of national reporters who've been covering Iowa elections for a long time. They really understand the lay of the land and how people here tend to think about things. So It's a fun question to try to answer correctly.
Despite being a frustrating question. And I mean, your props to the National Reporters also raises this issue of right now on that national political stage, a lot of anti-journalism sentiment, anti-journalism, anti-journalist.
Yeah, when I was covering the 2015-2016 Iowa caucuses, I covered the Trump campaign for a while, and so really felt kind of the rise of fake news very personally and very viscerally sometimes. It's a really strange experience to stand in the back of a political rally and have people turn around and call you scum or other words. So it's been interesting to see that shift, but I think as journalists, we've always struggled to maintain credibility with our readers, and to try to maintain that over time. But if 2016 taught us lessons, that's definitely one of them, that we have to work harder to maintain credibility. And I like working at a place like the Register, where I know who my readers are, I know who that is, and kind of how they're consuming our coverage.
Iowa does have a really big role in presidential primaries, and you are in the thick of it right now. Can you tell me more about what that's like?
It's really chaotic right now. At any given moment, we have multiple candidates in the state. Today, I think there are four or five people here who are campaigning, and it would be higher if it weren't for the impeachment trial keeping the senators in D.C. So while they're not here, they're sending out all of their best surrogates, and whether that's musicians, TV personalities, political figures, they're sending everyone they can to come out and be a voice for them here in Iowa in this final push. And so, you know, our last polling here at the Register said only 40% of likely Democratic caucus goers in Iowa have made up their mind about who they want to support. And so kind of baked into the culture of Iowa caucus goers here is deciding at the last minute, kind of weighing the entire field for as long as possible and then picking. And so these candidates know that these are really critical weeks and days where they have to put their best foot forward, where they have to start converting people. And so on top of the candidates themselves, they've hired armies of staffers who are across the state. I think we have several hundred people here right now working on behalf of these campaigns who are meeting with people one-on-one, they're organizing events, they're trying to get people out to have conversations. And so there's just a frantic pace of activity kind of always buzzing under the scenes right now. And so my job is to kind of keep an eye on all of that and to figure out what's most important every day, every week, and work with our reporters who are embedded within the campaigns who are going out to all of those events to bring those stories forward.
Have you seen anything in Des Moines so far this season that has really like piqued your antennas, kind of like, wow, that's something I don't think I would have seen in a previous election?
That's a really good question. One thing that's been really interesting with such a huge field of candidates is just how many staffers there are. So there was, and it's, you know, Iowa politics can be kind of a small world. Sometimes a lot of people know each other and work together. I remember I was standing in line at a coffee shop, and I ran into John Hickenlooper's Iowa State Director at the time. And he was married to Kirsten Gillibrand's state director. And he said, well, my wife is at home making work calls, so I had to leave. I had to get out. And so that's how much overlap there is right now, that like even within the same household, you've got people working for different campaigns.
I would also think, I mean, you as a journalist, it's sort of obvious what your role in all of this is, but I would think even someone like clergy in Iowa are probably, you know, point people for campaigns on some level. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these campaigns, you know, their goal is to become as embedded in the community as possible. There was a New York Times piece just the other day about some staffers from three different campaigns who were all living together in supporter housing. And one of the staffers had said he had joined the local church to get to know people there. And so part of these campaigns' jobs is, you know, they bring in people from out of state. And so they try really hard to become part of the community in really meaningful ways. You know, so you can't always fake relationships with people. And so, you know, he found a church and got involved and started meeting people there. And that's part of how campaigning in Iowa works.
Do you feel like the full-time residents of Iowa, the people of Iowa, are as vested in what's happening there as the politicians descending on Iowa?
Definitely a segment of them. I wouldn't say it's true for everyone. There are a relatively small number of people who caucus. I believe that 2008 record turnout was something like 180,000 people. So as a percentage of Iowa's population, it's not huge, the number of people who do caucus. But those who do, I would say, are deeply invested. You know, it's kind of a joke, but it's funny because it's true. You meet so many Iowans who will say, well, I haven't decided who I'm caucusing for because I haven't seen them all yet. You know, they're committed to going and seeing every single person at an event before they decide whether to support them, because they want to have had the experience of shaking their hand, looking them in the eye. Because I do think, having seen so many of these politicians both on TV and in person, you do get a really different sense of them when you can see them face to face. And so Iowans take that really seriously.
If you were to imagine some scenario where Iowa doesn't hold what some see as an arbitrary kind of power, given the timing of the primaries and everything, do you think this whole region, meaning the Midwest, loses something?
It depends on what comes to replace it, right? I think Iowa prides itself on being a voice for the Midwest, for some rural parts of America. But that doesn't mean there aren't other states that could also do well. But I do think, you know, we talk about trade in the debate because it matters in Iowa and it matters to farmers and manufacturers across the Midwest. So I do think it gives a voice to a lot of these issues that otherwise might not be as high profile.
What do you think that those of us outside of Iowa maybe don't get about what's happening where you are and what the conversation sounds like where you are?
That's a really great question. This was all really fascinating to see as an outsider, right? I'm not a native Iowan. So coming in and just seeing how much access people have to these candidates was really astounding. You know, you can go to these events, and if you want, you can meet just about every candidate in the field. You can take a picture with them and ask them a question. So the access is really amazing. And so I think in turn, Iowans do take it really seriously, weighing their responsibility. Right now, you meet a lot of people who are at these events. You know, the pressure of going first is really getting to a lot of people. You meet them and they say, oh my gosh, I can't decide. I'm weighing this. I'm weighing that factor. Like, what are they thinking in South Carolina? Does that matter to what I'm doing here? So just all of it, and just the cultural infrastructure that exists around the caucuses is really kind of incredible, the way that it's so deeply ingrained in everything here. There are like cottage industries that pop up around the caucuses.
Like what?
So like I was talking to a makeup artist who says that, you know, a bunch of her business is related to the caucuses because politicians come in and they need to be on TV, and so they book them as freelancers. There's a TV studio that has popped up entirely because of people needing to be on TV from Iowa. There are so many people from DC who are doing cable hits to CNN or MSNBC who are in Des Moines who need to be on TV. So these things have popped up around the caucuses that are really fascinating.
The pressure that Iowa voters feel and really take to heart, which you were just describing, that puts some really intense pressure on you by extension as the person mediating information specifically for the ones casting those first votes in the country and still making up their mind.
It does. And it's fun because people are so engaged, but it is a lot of pressure to get things right and to provide a level playing field for these candidates. You know, I think especially at the Register, we really pride ourselves on giving an equal playing field. Like when we first started doing polling of the field back last December, more than a year ago, when there were 24 candidates running, you know, we polled on all 24 of them. And that's not something that everybody does, but we kind of think here in Iowa, if you're here running an actual campaign, if you're here competing, you deserve to have a shot. And so we saw some of those candidates rise. I mean, Andrew Yang is someone that not everyone was polling on early and now was on not this most recent debate stage, but the one before that, who has come a really long way. So we do feel that pressure and we try to respond appropriately at the Register.
Did moderating a debate on a national stage reveal something to you about the state of discourse or the democratic process itself that you just hadn't quite put your finger on before?
I don't know that anything really illuminating. One thing that was interesting was thinking about these candidates and what matters on a debate stage and trying to find places where there are areas of disagreement, where, you know, thinking about how voters are going to be making up their minds and how they're choosing between Democrats and where they do agree on so many issues and trying to find that daylight in some places was really interesting. It's also interesting always watching the debates and even being part of them, realizing how much you don't get to talk about, how quickly 2 hours can go when you're trying to get all of your questions into that many people.
Breanne Fonensteel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Breanne is a Kansas native who helped moderate the last Democratic debate in Iowa. She works for the Des Moines Register now. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, fighting your fears with a hope shield on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And I don't mean to freak anyone out, but with a continent on fire, dire predictions for the fate of the planet, an impeachment trial having just about begun, and a looming sense that we may be on the brink of another war, a children's book called It Will Be Okay sounds very compelling. And the author, based here in Kansas City, is with us now to talk about the book, as well as what we can learn from it about managing anxiety and fear. Vladimir Sante, author of It Will Be Okay, welcome to the show.
Thank you very, very much.
Tell me the story in this book. It's about a girl named Alma.
Correct. So It Will Be Okay is about a young Latino girl named Alma, who has been struggling with fear and anxiety. And so the book kind of encompasses, surrounds what she's experiencing in those moments, what symptoms look like for a young girl her age to be experiencing when she's having these anxiety-related situations.
What inspired you to write this book?
So what inspired me to write this book kind of goes to the beginning of my first book, Just Like a Hero. Throughout my professional clinical career, I've worked with youths and young adults who have struggled to know their worth. A lot of kiddos who I've done therapy with didn't really understand their value because they were kind of stigmatized because of their mental health. And so I remember being in a session with a young African-American boy, and we were sitting down, and I was going through some of my books because I'm really big into bibliotherapy, and I wanted to find something that we can read to talk about because he was experiencing some depression-related symptoms in that moment, and I wanted to find a book that kind of talked about what was happening, what was going on with him, and I couldn't find anything, and I just remember being annoyed by that emotion and telling myself, you know what, I love art, I know mental health, if I want to see this, then I need to be the change and do it myself. So that kind of spiraled this evolution of my book series. And I kind of remember creating this comic strip and taking it to my wife, who, and we just had our second child at the moment, and which freaked her out because she knows when I have these grandiose kind of big ideas,
I can become a little less available.
Yeah. I check out.
But I mean, so this first, the first in your series, tell me more about that book.
Sure. Just Like a Hero is about a young boy named Will who is struggling with his own self-worth. And he has a lot of cognitive distortions about who he is. He doesn't like his skin tone. He thinks he is not smart. And because of a lot of things that he's thinking about, it manifests into anger and frustration. And I really wanted to kind of like focus on that because in my career, I've come across a lot of hurt children who a lot of times get a bad rep because they're seen as this defiant or bad mannered child. But there's more going on under the hood than just this, you know, oppositional kid. And I wanted to create this.
They are still kids.
Yeah, they are still kids, right? Because I wanted people to understand if we come to a place of compassion and understanding when we see kiddos with their heads down on a table and change our mindset of what's wrong to what's going on, we could do a lot more good.
Can you explain that distinction, what's wrong versus what's going on?
So that kind of derived, that does, not kind of, but that does derive from a trauma-informed perspective and framework of understanding that trauma is, it plays a part in an individual's worldview and perspective. So we should alter our understanding of, you're not bad. There are bad things happening.
There's not something wrong.
Right. There are bad things happening. So if I can figure out what those bad things are, then I can treat the problem a little more effectively and proficiently.
Okay. We're going to get back to It Will Be Okay. Sure. But tell me about your own background, where you're from, your own childhood, just so that...
Oh, we want to go way deep.
Yeah, I do, because... who is the person writing these stories, I think, matters.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I actually am originally from Queens, New York. I moved out here at the age of 16 to live with my uncle. Just a little bit quickly about my background. I kind of was that defiant kid because both my parents immigrated from Haiti. So when they came here, they were trying to follow the American way of working a lot of jobs and weren't really around as much. And so I was, you know, seeking attention in a sense. And I remember one of the things that really kind of like hit the nail for my mom of basically sending me to my uncle so he can help me was that one of the things that I did was basically take the E train to Manhattan because I didn't want to go home after school. So that really kind of like set the bar up for her, and she was just done at that point. So
what was it like arriving here in Kansas City?
It was different. I had a lot of false perceptions about Kansas City because I thought, you know, there were windmills and things from Wizard of Oz. That's what I thought of Kansas City. So I was blown away when I realized that you guys had a downtown. And I was at the age of 16.
Well, so as you began writing children's books yourself to sort of fill the gap on your shelf as you were seeking bibliotherapy for mm-hmm. your, for people.
My clients.
Who, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is, I've never heard the term bibliotherapy, but I feel like I informally yes. do that for myself.
Oh, yeah. It is. It's just reading a book to help you kind of challenge what's going on. Because sometimes, specifically with kids, and again, why I kind of went down this road, is that they do not have the verbal literacy as adults, right? Their brains are not fully developed. So it's kind of like our job / our mandate as adults to kind of teach them those emotional skills for self-regulation, for communication.
Just get mad at them when they don't exhibit them.
Oh, it's so hard not to get mad, right? Especially when you're a parent. But yeah, to be more mindful of, okay, I need to put my oxygen mask on right now and then help you, because if I'm not calm and regulated, then you being dysregulated and I'm being dysregulated is not going to bode well. So
back to your most recent book, It Will Be Okay. I want to talk about the hope shield. Alma makes a hope shield mm-hmm. to protect her from the fear monster. Mm-hmm. What is this imagery doing for your young readers who might have their own versions of fear monsters?
Okay. So I created Limbo, the fear monster, to give kiddos a external representation or manifestation of what fear can be or look at, because again, their brains are not fully developed, so it's really hard for them to kind of like verbalize, or, you know, if I'm feeling upset, how do I basically outline that and call it out? So I wanted to create this manifestation so kiddos can like identify that. So Alma creates the hope shield to remind her of the things that she learns in therapy that can counteract when I'm feeling anxious or worried. I can take a deep breath. I can relax, listen to music. I can do something of physical activity that helps me to calm down.
I understand that you had a group of kids actually making hope shields at Wonderscope a
yes.
couple weeks back. What was it like to see that in action, taken very literally?
It was actually the first time I saw that into practice. And I actually used my daughter as a guinea pig when I very first hope shield I made. And so to see a group of kiddos sit down and kind of outline things that they want to do if they're feeling scared or stuck was very profound to me. One kid, I believe he wrote down, is that I could take a nap, which is fine. If you're feeling it, then do it.
Is this an exercise that might be useful for adults? I mean, I mentioned that regardless of just all the normal pressures on us as people susceptible to the human condition, that like the headlines are terrifying right now. And I wonder if there if this is something that people of any age could learn from.
You know, I think as adults, because of all the things that's going on right now in our community, sometimes, and this goes even for myself, we need to slow down. We need to take a time and kind of regroup and rethink and sitting down. And I hope she'll, to me, as an adult, will be a safety plan or a coping skills plan. And actually, I'm all for mental health awareness. So creating a card that has three things I can do when I'm feeling either anxious or worried or sad, and keeping that in my wallet, whether that's taking a 5-minute break at work and walking around the block, or going to see another coworker who I like to enjoy spending time with at work and just having laughs. That's part of it.
Is there a big difference to consider in how kids process fear and how adults do it?
The main thing in my clinical impression when that is happening is to, again, go back to the understanding that kids are, their brains are still developing, right? So again, their emotional literacy is not as advanced as adults. So it goes back to us making sure that we're teaching them and we're kind of bringing them up to that level of awareness. Because a lot of times you will hear that EQ is better than IQ. So you could be the super smart adult working at your company, but if your emotional intelligence is not up to that level, then when that hard report comes in and you're scrambling and you're having these bouts of anxiety and you're not checking that, then it doesn't help.
Do kids need things from us that we may not appreciate in terms of coping with fear and anxiety? One thing that I just can imagine is that they aren't necessarily reporting all of their fears and anxieties to us. You know, like as adults, we kind of have to watch for them or anticipate them.
I think we can create the space that it's okay, tagline, to allow kiddos to spread, come to us in those moments to talk about it. One big thing that my wife and I do in our household is that we don't shy from mental health. If I'm going through something, if my wife is going through something, and we'll talk to our daughter about it. I have a mood monitor. When I was a therapist, I would have a mood monitor in my office. And each time kiddos or parents would come in, I would have them pick out emotions to check in so I can see how everyone's doing. Because I think the more awareness, the more comfortable we make mental health, the better it will be.
You talked about your own background, mm-hmm. and that you were seeking attention, dealing with pretty rough things. And
yeah.
Were sent to live with your uncle in Kansas City. And I am curious about whether the process of writing children's books for kids experiencing those exact things has been healing for you.
I've had that question come up some in parts. And I will say this, writing my first book was bibliotherapy for me. Like it basically was a therapy session, because there are components in Will that I was experiencing as a young black male. One of the things was that I was not comfortable with my skin tone. I didn't like it at all. So it took some time for me to become okay in my own skin.
Very literally in your own skin.
Yeah, very literally in my own skin. So I remember just feeling that way. And what really hit home for me was working with this kiddo who was not okay with his skin tone, to the point where he wanted to take sandpaper and he thought he could rub it off. And so, yeah, those sessions were hard. So I remember just like hearing his story and kind of working with him and thinking to myself, why is there not a book that looks like us that talks about mental health? So again, that diversity and inclusion was another big component to me. And that's where all my series will be of diverse components to it.
And then the It Will Be Okay being the most recent book. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you feel like you actively learned writing that book?
I have high levels of sarcasm.
That's
very,
what you
very
learned.
Nerdy, very nerdy sarcasm. No, one thing that I learned was that there is a, in my opinion, room for books like this, because I don't see them a lot, and I'm just I'm humbled and excited that it's being received with such high praise. Obviously, I didn't think it was. I originally just created this so I can use in my sessions. So the fact that people are taking into this and utilizing it currently at Truman, where I work as a team leader, there were a couple copies in our waiting area. So when kiddos would come and wait for their either appointments to see their psychiatrist or therapist, they had access to my very first book, which was cool because I remember walking out into the main lobby and seeing this little boy and his sister reading my book. And that was uplifting because, again, going back to just the profound need for more mental awareness, it starts there. Like, I feel like we need to talk more about it and make it okay.
Just have those books lying around.
Yeah, just have those books lying around. They could be in a counselor's office. They could be in the front lobby of a mental health facility or in your home. So
you're writing these books, it seems like, from at least three different perspectives. One being like a former child who can relate to the characters on a very personal level. Another being as a mental health professional who has a whole like vocabulary around mental health states and emotional intelligence that the average person does not. And then also as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, we haven't talked a lot about where that parent voice kind of guides you.
It guides me like a ship heading towards shore. So it's...
As like you feel kind of adrift as a parent sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah, right. Without the current support and a lot of our clients feel that way too, because like without the current support and assistance, we can't drown. Parenting is not easy. but writing myself being a parent and it's shifting the way I would write my book is that if I was a dad and I didn't have my clinical background, how can I understand this, digest it, and kind of regurgitate it back to my child? So I wanted to make the writing simplistic and easy and transferable so anyone can read it to a kid.
When you think about this whole journey of writing children's books, which was sort of an unplanned part of your journey.
Super unplanned.
What has that been like?
Breathtaking. I sat down and I still have a smile on my face that this
you
is really happening.
You do have a smile on
it. This is really happening. So it's just been, again, just profoundly amazing that, again, there's, and it breaks my heart that, again, I don't see more. I would love to see more of this. So maybe this will start something. But
you're talking about a combination of things when you say this. You're talking about diverse characters in children's books and
mental health.
That combination very specifically.
Yes, who find value in their being, and because they know they're powerful, they come out at the end stronger than before.
Do you think that there is, in your practice, in your clinical practice, you have seen a gap there in that understanding and that sort of modeling?
I actually have worked with a lot of kiddos who have struggled to know the value of their worth. And again, this is at times because maybe they're in schools or maybe they're in a community and they may have a visceral reaction or behavioral challenge. And either other people in a... So, for instance, I had a mom tell me that her kiddo was struggling at a department store and she was so ashamed and felt so alone because she was trying to help her son who was struggling. And then everyone around her kept looking at her like she was a bad parent. She's not a bad parent. So it just, I think more needs to be illuminated around that concept of if we see a hurt kid, what can we do as adults who have more emotional literacy, right? More understanding.
Instead of looking for a finger to point
at. Yeah, instead of like, oh my God, you're horrible. Get your kid together, lady. Like, no, that's not okay.
Is there something in our culture that you can leave us with that we should just maybe think twice about as far as the messages that are being sent to kids about their self-worth that we might not even recognize as adults?
A message? One message that I would love to leave with everyone is that just remember that there's more going on to a child than what we're seeing on the outside. So if we could take a time to be compassionate and understanding, it will go a long way in helping an individual.
Our time is up. Vladimir Sante, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Vlad is the author of a children's book called It Will Be Okay. It's the most recent in a whole series that draws on his own expertise as a mental health professional, as well as his experience from his own childhood and as a parent. You can listen back to either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you can sign up to have all our interviews sent right to you, so you can listen at your own convenience, kind of like a podcast. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, speaking of podcasts, there's a really popular one called Generation Y, made here in Kansas City. We'll meet the people behind it on our show. That's tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.